Mets fans, I want to take a quick break from talking baseball and let you know about the next top prospect in building a smart home. Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 is that big-time new star prospect. The Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 is a smart lock, a 2K resolution camera, and a doorbell. It's three devices in one, triple the security. You know triples are rare in baseball, but not with Eufy. You can have everything in one device rather than install many pieces on your front door. It's not just for security, but also for convenience. Just the other night, I had tons of packages in the rain. Rather than fumble for my keys, I easily entered my home. This is big since I have four dogs who are impatiently waiting for me at the door. No more concerns about losing keys, and you could assign passwords to your family members. Worried about when your loved ones are getting home? Eufy allows you to see them coming back home via the integrated camera. Hey, Mets fans, this is a home run. I had a competitive product before Eufy, and it's the difference between a one-dimensional hitter and a five-tool player. Eufy is that five-tool superstar. Go to eufy.com, that's EUFY.com to learn more. Already sold? Go to Amazon and get your Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 today. Want to go to the store? Best Buy will have it starting around May 20th. Get complete control over your front door at ease with the Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 today.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from Minute Media.
So McCarthy is fanned, and the Diamondbacks are down to their final out. And now Seth Beer will come up to pinch hit. He struck him out. Now the ball game is over. Diaz works around a leadoff walk in the ninth. The Mets have their third shutout in their first 10 games. A combined five-hitter.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, April the 17th, 2022. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to welcome in the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network and, of course, our friends over at RisingApple.com. Happy Easter, happy Passover, happy Ramadan. The trinity of holidays, I guess, all come together here on this Sunday. Opening weekend at Citi Field, our first home series of 2022. You couldn't have asked for better weather. Well, maybe today you could have asked for a little better weather. Didn't it feel a little bit like, early November, late October at the MetLife and the Giants and Jets are playing? But anyway, it's spring. It's somewhat baseball weather, and what a weekend. And the theme of this show, even though coming in you heard the clincher, the final out, Edwin Diaz nailing down the final out of a three-game opening weekend series, the theme is Tom Seaver. And I have a really fun guest, and we're going to be spending the majority of the program. And I know it's hard. You're going to be saying, well, really, what more can I learn about Tom Seaver? 300-game winner, Hall of Famer, the 77 trade deadline. Now the statue has been unveiled. Finally, after all these years, the complaints about no Mets history, Jackie Robinson Rotunda, nothing wrong with that, but that's not a Mets player. Now they finally get the statue. Well, what more can we talk about, Mike? Well, I actually have a guest that I think you'll find interesting because I was thinking about this weekend for a long while. And back in the middle of the pandemic, a book came out called Tom Seaver and Me. And I'm not sure if you guys have read it. If you haven't, you certainly should check it out. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. But Pat Jordan, long-term author, long-term journalist, met Tom Seaver all the way in the early 1970s. Actually, and I was able to scrounge it up, had an article written in Sports Illustrated that you could actually get out of the vault, and I'm going to bring that up for all of you. I should have had it up before the show, but, you know, here I am doing a million things. Tom Terrific and His Mystic Talent, July 24th, 1972. Really just, I think it was the first introduction to, sitting down with Tom. He had known Tom, and he became friendly with Tom, but really it was showing the human side of Tom Seaver. Back all the way back in 1972. This is after the 69 World Series. This is after his Cy Young Award. This is after striking out all those Padres. This is after the near perfect game with Jimmy Qualls in 1969, in July 1969. And Pat Jordan, who you could check out, has both also fiction books over there as well. PatJordanStories.com. You can write, there's the best of sports writing, stuff that you may not have seen if you are familiar with Pat. But Pat was a minor league baseball player himself, a guy that the Milwaukee Braves bonus baby was drafted, had no command and control. You think Miguel Castro drives me nuts? You think Edwin Diaz drives me nuts? You think Sean Reed Foley drives me nuts? Well, Pat Jordan, I think, walked like 6 or 7, 8 or 9 per 9 innings in his career. You can check him out over at Baseball Reference. When his career was over, he went into sports writing, struck up this 40-plus year friendship with Seaver. And I think, and I had a chance to talk to him Friday morning early, just hours before the statue ceremony. And I wanted to get his reaction to the Seaver statue. Give us a little bit, or try to get a little bit out of him about maybe something about Tom Seaver, the man, that we didn't know. I mean, everybody who has come in contact with Seaver has something to say, you know, whether it be a good experience, bad experience from an autographs situation. I know the writers. I've talked to Bob Clappish. I know guys who have covered him. Marty Noble came on the program many, many years. The late Marty Noble, I know we talked to him. I mean, Seaver was a complicated guy, not always easy to cover, challenged you. I mean, many of you in the audience who are in my generation probably remember Seaver more as a broadcaster when he was on the old sports channel, up until about 2005 when he was on there with Ted Robinson and Fran Healy. I mean, Tom was sometimes a bit arrogant and difficult to take as a broadcaster, but a Hall of Fame pitcher, personifies the birth of the Mets and the rise of the Mets, and he is the Mets. You know, you have, and again, I keep saying it, Mike Piazza doing a great job as the ambassador of the alumni group, and Mike is the Mets for a generation of Mets fans, but Tom is the Mets. I mean, that's the Mets Babe Ruth. That's where it all starts, and that's where it all emanates from, and any Mount Rushmore of Mets starts with Tom Seaver. He's never going to be kicked off of that, no matter what comes 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years down the line. So Pat Jordan, you'll have a chance to hear that in just a couple of minutes. You know, as far as the Mets, you know, we talked a lot about the bullpen on the short that came out on Thursday. I'm not going to get too deep into the ball club after this week, and basically chalk. They beat a bad Diamondbacks club 2 out of 3. They'll see them again next week. I mean, within a week, they'll be done with the Diamondbacks. They have their first test series against the Giants. You heard 3 shutouts in 10 games. The starting pitching has been fabulous. They're leading the league, despite all the grumblings about how not everybody's hitting. They're leading the league. They're tied with the Dodgers for the most runs scored. In 10 games, they've scored 51 runs. That's 5.1 runs per game. Right around what the calculator, I'm telling you, I'm going to make this a thing. We sat there at the beginning of the year. We threw the numbers in. We threw all these different iterations. The calculator, I'm going to call it the calculator, the Baseball Musings calculator, says the Mets should score 5.2, 5.3 runs per game. They're at 5.1 now. They're right there. So we'll see if the calculator is right, and for a change, some of the projections come true. Really, to me, what I took away from this week, and I'm going to throw everything that was on the field, whether it be Pete Alonso's performance, the starting pitching, the bullpen, the good, the bad, the ugly, Buck, really, with the J.D. Davis play on the Ollie Perez on the mound over there. I mean, Ollie Perez is still pitching. I feel like Scott Rowland's ball was just hit yesterday. What the hell's going on here? The heads-up play by J.D. Davis to negate the appeal play at third. That's the Buck Showalter effect. I mean, a heads-up Mets team, something that for many, many years you never would expect to see. The Mets are usually on the other end of something like that. all that good stuff we'll put aside. You know, one fifth of the way through this getting to know phase, right? That's what we call it here at the Talking Mets podcast. I want to really focus on when I saw that sea of fans at Citi Field on Friday. I was just amazed when I saw the panoramic of the crowd from above, how many fans came out on a Friday. Good Friday, first day of Passover. So there's some religious aspects to it. A work day. I mean, I know now we're remote work and, you know, 3-day work weeks. I know work is not work. Everything's different. Everything's negotiable. Work's not work. Baseball's not baseball. Extra innings is not extra innings. Everything's negotiable, right? But still, you think there's some semblance of normalcy in the world right now. But it's a Friday during the day, 11:30 in the morning. This huge sea of crowd. I think it was Gary Cohn or Howie Rose said it looked like Woodstock. I mean, it looked like a concert in the park or somewhere. A tremendous turnout. I thought Steve Cohen did a nice job. I thought Nancy Seaver did a nice job. I thought Mike Piazza did a nice job. I mean, to unveil this statue, and I know Tom is important to the Mets, but you know how many times the Mets have had days and they just didn't turn out right? Yeah, 88 when they had Tom Seaver Day and all that stuff and what have you. That was one thing. That was a great crowd on a Sunday. But I remember when he was elected to the Hall of Fame, I think in 1992, it got rained out. And it always seems like even, you know, the night I went to the 86 celebration, what was it, 2006, it was 20 years. It rained that night, so there's always that concern that there would be an issue. You know, obviously there was Mike Piazza Day, and that went really well. But he always, I felt like sometimes these Mets days, something doesn't happen, whether it be weather-wise, the game doesn't mean anything, there's something going on with the team in the backdrop. Something always is going on. Today, not today, but Friday, April 15th, a day no more for taxes than anything, right? It was perfect. And then you couple that with Jackie Robinson, and obviously we know Jackie Robinson and what he did for the sport and the importance of his integration. And by the way, he's a pretty darn good ball player. I mean, I think the biggest thing, non sequitur here, about Jackie Robinson that gets overlooked is look at those numbers on Baseball Reference. That's an elite, 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 elite run creator. Forget about the color barrier for a minute. The guy could have played on my team any day of the week. He could have been purple. I mean, let's just put it that way. So he earned every bit of what he got, and we know what he went through. You have that with the number 42 uniforms. Butch Husky in the house. I mean, Steve Cohen could not be doing a 180 about Mets history than what he's done. Now, hopefully they don't overdo it. I know they're doing the Santana no-hitter later this year, and they got a lot of fun stuff planned. So, you know, the Mets don't have a short history. They're becoming a mature team, but you don't want to throw all the history in one shot and then you're repeating it every year. Or now you're like, all right, we did everything in 20. We made up for 50 plus years in 2022. That's it. But anyway, I digress here. What I saw with that crowd is how this fan base, and I've talked about it. Yes, it's a yoke around their neck, whoever comes here. Yes, there's all this paranoia and bad energy and failure that is chasing them. And whoever, and if it's Buck or somebody else, whoever breaks through and wins and gets that yoke broken, that 86 yoke that's around their neck off and has the next generation of a Mets championship, they will be canonized. And if you don't think, if I'm Steve Cohen, I'm standing around, I'm like, look at this. And I see all those empty junkyards out there, that this part of Queens, and I know COVID politics, you know, eminent domain, I get all the stuff. I'm not getting into any of that. I'm just talking conceptually here. If you don't think that that area and this fan base is begging for a breakthrough, for there to be like a Mets village with hotels and shops and apartments and all good stuff, in all due respect, I don't want to see them just plop up a housing project over there. Like, I think they should have a village, like, you know, when you go to Pittsburgh or Wrigleyville or something really cool, that could be all Mets, and it could be inclusive to bring people together, and, you know, it really could bring the Mets to the next level. I mean, think about the Yankees and all the Yankees have gotten from the media, and as much as they have all that history that follows them from stadium to stadium, and they got stands over there, and I've been on River Avenue and whatnot, and there seems to be a certain amount of charm over there, but they don't even have a village. They don't even have a, you know, they have the bat. You really look at that and you're like, this team and this brand is ready to explode. They have one of the the richest owner in the game worth $15 billion who wants to make this kind of his legacy, who can use this as a medallion and become an even bigger part of society, more so than just dollars and cents. Could you imagine what he can be in this franchise history, if he could take this team and get it to the next level, not just from winning a championship, but from the experience at Citi Field? And you just saw the scratching of the surface with what that Seaver ceremony was all about. And we'll have some clips going into the break before we get Pat Jordan up. So that's what I was thinking about. I'm looking at this. I'm like, right in front of me, as I'm looking at that ceremony, as I see from above, they had the shot. There's the yoke in front of you, the pressure and the expectation and the demands, but there's also the excitement, the energy. Yeah, there was no energy in the park today, but it's Sunday, Easter, and Passover. You couldn't expect that. But think about Friday in the blowout win, and then when Marte hit that home run on Saturday. I know Saturday was a bummer, but the crowd, I mean, this should be one of the more ultimate home field advantages in the sport, right up there at Yankee Stadium. Yeah, they don't have the chains and the ghost and Babe Ruth and all the other stuff that comes with. Well, that was really the old Yankee Stadium, not the new Yankee Stadium. But you get where I'm going. They can make their own thing here. And it really gives me a lot of hope and excitement. Now, we know as Mets fans and me covering this team, the best laid plans, I could be listening to this in 5 months. You're like, Mike, what the hell were you thinking there on Easter Sunday? But I really believe We're beginning to see something really iconic and special, and we're living in Mets history. We are literally living in Mets history when this franchise is changing. Maybe the area around that stadium is changing, but everything we've been wanting, the history part, a club that spends money, a fun club, a club that's building a foundation and a culture of winning with a competent manager, something they haven't had maybe in ever. At least since the 80s. Maybe you could put Bobby Valentine in there for sure. But in forever, it seems, is all there. And to me, that's what I took away from Tom Seaver Day. The hope that we are living in a new era of Mets history. An era that we're all going to remember and we're all a part of. And when we're older, 40 years from now, we're looking into the history books. And you have a grandson or a nephew or whoever in your life, you know, is young at that time, says, you know, talk to me about what the Mets were, because I can't imagine a time when the media made fun of the Mets and the Mets had no hope and the Mets didn't spend money and they played in this nice little stadium called Shea Stadium. But what do you mean? There was junkyards outside? There was nothing around this Metsville? I don't know. And maybe it's a pipe dream because of New York City politics and all the other things that go into building around anything here in New York City. But I got to think there's tons of opportunity as we move away from the pandemic and hopefully a different New York City, that would be part of the plans. It should have been years ago, and I guess obviously the other things were more important. Part of that was building the stadium. So anyway, let's take a quick break. When I return, we'll listen to a couple of highlights from Friday's Seaver statue ceremony. Pat Jordan, author, also wrote a book, Tom Seaver and Me. Get a chance to hear a little bit about Pat Jordan's friendship with Tom Seaver. And maybe he'll give you something that you didn't know about Seaver and peel the curtain back a little bit. I know you've heard it all, but I think you might learn something from Pat Jordan. We'll be back with that and more right after this.
Tom led us to our first championship. He transformed the Mets, transfixed New York, and won the hearts of Mets fans. Tom Seaver was a great pitcher. An even greater man. He was poised and intelligent, and he represented our team as a proud Marine with dignity, excellence, and honor.
It's been said that humility is royalty without the crown. That's why Tom Seaver is our royalty. A humble warrior, Tom brought many things to all of us, but I think the biggest thing he brought to us was faith. Faith in this team, faith in this organization, and faith in all of you, the fans. And that's why we love him, and that's why we'll always cherish him. And this statue is a beautiful tribute and a memory that we will always hold special in our hearts. So God bless.
I need to express my gratitude to the Met organization for having this very special tribute for Tom. Of course, I can't mention the fans enough. Thank you all for showing up here today. It's so good to see you again, and all the Met hats. And yeah, you're always so enthusiastic and supportive to the Seaver family, and I really appreciate that. Well, yeah, we love you.
Pat Jordan. You guys may have read the book. It came out a couple of years ago, Tom Seaver and Me. Pat was a former minor league pitcher himself, and he had a chance to interview Tom Seaver, and then many years later wrote a book about his interactions. And he's joining us just a few hours away from a long overdue honor from his former team at Citi Field, where Tom Seaver's statue will be unveiled on opening day today as the Mets play the Arizona Diamondbacks. And Pat, welcome to the program. And I'm guessing when you interviewed Tom Seaver all those years ago, you wouldn't think it would take, 50 plus years for the Mets to finally honor one of the, you know, there's really no argument.
No,
the greatest
I didn't.
Player. And here we are.
I didn't think it would take so long.
And here we are on this this great spring day in New York. So how you doing? And welcome to the program.
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here. Anything for Tom? Listen, I know Tom when he was a kid. He was 27, I was 30. And the very first thing we did was play basketball against each other and beat each other up. And he liked that. And anyway, we got along really well over 40, 45 years. And we were very similar guys. He was more of a... He was a smart guy who always thought he was just a blue-collar guy. He didn't think he was as smart as he should have. And I was a blue-collar guy who was doing a white-collar job, you know. So we got along great. As far as the Mets go, I know Nancy was really pissed off that they hadn't had a statue for him, especially took so long that he's dead. He should have been there at the moment, you know. Other than that, I didn't even know the statue was going to be put up today.
Wow. Wow.
How big is it?
I've seen some photos. I mean, they haven't really unveiled everything, but
yeah.
It looks beautiful. I mean, if you think about other statues, you know, Philadelphia, they have yeah. Mike Schmidt and whatnot. I think everybody kind of uses the same format, but it's there as you walk into that rotunda. The rotunda that... Look, Jackie Robinson is an iconic sports figure. There's no argument. But I guess when you're talking about the Mets, Jackie Robinson is more of a baseball icon, and there's nothing wrong with it. But the controversy was, why not the Mets? And I think with now the new ownership, and I'll tell you what, Pat, I'll give Mike Piazza, who has been on the show and I've talked to many times, credit as a Hall of Famer, former Met, a guy who's a more modern-day player. He's taken seriously kind of being that – spokesperson for the alumni group for the Mets, and he'll be there today. And I think you're seeing a new era in, Mets baseball where they're embracing their history. I know it's a difficult history, and you were there. You interviewed Tom back in the early 70s when, like you said, he was in his 20s and just 3 years after the Miracle Mets. So you saw them when the Mets were babies. They really had no history, and you were there as it was unfolding.
Oh, yeah. I saw them when they were, losing and all that. Tom loved the Mets, and he wanted, he was really brokenhearted when they sent him to Cincinnati, and especially the thing with Dick Young and Donald Grant. It really broke his heart. But then again, he told me, he said, I wouldn't have won 300 games if I stayed with the Mets. Because
that's interesting.
Right after he left the Mets, they lost. They couldn't win a game, and he was sort of good to Cincinnati hitting team. And Cincinnati might not have been as good as they should have been as a team, but they were a great hitting team, which made them a perfect team for Tom. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he was the top pitcher on the team. I mean, with the hell, the first half a year with him, he went 14-1. The year when the Mets let him go. He told me he would never have won 300 games if he had stayed with the Mets.
That's interesting. So. And it's complicated. And you mentioned the complicated history. And it's amazing how the best player in the franchise, 300-game winner, you'll probably never see a 300-game winner, not because of anything about talent, but the way the game is now in a Mets uniform.
Yeah.
Not only was he traded, the controversial trade, years later, and I think that was more of a benign situation. They leave him unprotected, Frank Cashin, and,
right.
and he wasn't there. He wasn't there for the glory of the 80s. Now, some argue, and we've talked about this. Was it better for Tom better for the Mets because you had Gooden and Darling, and those young pitchers may not have gotten a chance as quickly with Tom there. But then there's always that what if, and I'm wondering, did Tom have that what if? What if he was with that 85-86 team? Would things have been different? Would they have won another one? Would it have made a good and a better pitcher? We don't know, but that's the ultimate sometimes what if is the second round where it was more of
I think it was better for Tom not to be with that team, for him personally, because he wouldn't have had to be called back to the Mets long after his glory days were over, when he was no longer the pitcher he was when he was with the Mets, and have to be on a team as maybe the fourth starter behind Doc Gooden. And, you know, I think that would have been hard for him to take. I mean, he was a very proud man. And for the Mets to call him back, say, when Gooden and they had all those young pitchers, and he would be relegated to the fourth or fifth starter, I think that would have broken his heart, too. So it's better that he didn't come back.
And
that's my feeling.
You as a journalist, author, I've talked to those who covered Seaver. He was tough on writers. He wasn't easy to cover. So how did this relationship blossom? You mentioned a basketball game. You interview him early 70s when he's in his prime, young guy. You're a former minor league pitcher, and so you know a little bit about the journey. You didn't make it, but you know about the journey. So this is not common for you to connect with Tom.
The way we connected is I never thought Tom was a big deal. Hmm. I was better than Tom. In my mind, he told me once he pitched a no-hitter in Little League. I said, bullshit, I pitched four in a row. I said, and I struck out 18 batters every game. You know, when he was in high school, he was the fourth best pitcher on his club. I was averaging 15 strikeouts a game, and I had 16 scouts in every game I pitched. And I signed when I was 17 years old with the Braves right out of high school. So my point being, I always thought that I should have been Tom Seaver. And so I treated him as an equal. I was never obsequious with him, you know. I mean, I would call him up in the middle of the night sometimes and tell him what he was doing wrong with his curveball. And he'd say, well, what the hell do you know? I said, well, I know how to throw a curveball. You don't, obviously. You know, so we had an equal relationship. It was never an obsequious writer begging him for an interview. I mean, every once in a while, I would do a story like I needed some money when I was broke, and people wanted me to do a story on Tom and Nancy. And I called him up. He said, oh, I don't want to do people. He says, what am I going to be in a hot tub with my wife with champagne and all that? I said, he said, I don't want to do it. I said, okay. So he says, why do you want to do it? I said, because I need the money. He said, be here tomorrow.
Wow.
I was there the next day. We did the interview. I got the check. That's the kind of guy he was and the relationship we had. I was an athlete, and I was a pitcher, and I was a wise guy. And I didn't, you know, I said, if I had your control, nobody would even know your name. And all they would do was know my name because I was wild. So that attitude appealed to him because he's arrogant, and so was I.
Yep.
So we were on an equal basis. There was no – it was never writer, famous pitcher when we interviewed. They weren't interviews. They were me and Tom talking and having conversations back and forth about everything.
What?
You know?
It's
a,
It's interesting that you talk about that, because I remember I'm 45, so I didn't see Tom pitch, but I remember Tom as a broadcaster, and Tom, I think, looking back, struggled. Now, he's a broadcaster, 90s, turn of the century, so the game is not what it was today. I think he'd really struggle with what the game is today, much different game. But Tom struggled, I think, accepting anybody but the best. Like, I think, like, Pedro Martinez, he covered Pedro Martinez. There's a great pitcher that Tom could relate with. But, you know, as a fan or as a journalist, you're like, well, Tom, you know, yeah, that guy's got an ERA of 4.5, but he's a solid pitcher. He couldn't accept that. And I noticed that in the broadcast booth. He didn't like the game, I think, as much as
he didn't
as
like
others.
He didn't like anybody who didn't take it as seriously as he did. I never mentioned the guy's name, but it was Crane Pool. We were in spring training one year, 72, I think, St. Petersburg. We're behind the batting practice cage while they're having batting practice, and Crane Pool is taking his long, easy swings and hitting fly balls right to the warning track. And Tom looks at me and he says, if that was me, I'd find the strength to hit the ball 10 feet farther into the bleachers. He says, and he doesn't do it because Easy Ed was Easy Ed. He was a big guy, no muscle, soft. And he never, as far as Tom was concerned, he never went that extra 10%.
Interesting.
Drive the ball into the bleachers instead of just a nice fly ball to the warning track. So that's the kind of guy he was. He couldn't countenance that. The first time we played basketball, we beat the shit out of each other for like 3 hours. We had bloody noses and bruises and everything. And after the last game was the winner of the day, and he went driving in for a shot, and I was going to slam him into the wall. And just at the last minute, I didn't, because I said, oh, my God, it's Tom Seaver. I'm going to break his arm. I can't do it. So I let him have the layup, and he won the game. So at the end of the game, we're driving home, and I said, you know, I let you win that game. And he said, Jordan, I know you 3 hours, and I know you never let anybody win at anything. And that's what he liked. You know, and that was the foundation for our relationship. We were equals, and we were both super competitive. He was so much better at being competitive than I was, because he was disciplined competitive, but I was hot competitive.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. That's definitely two different types of competitive spirit. Tom Seaver and me, the author is Pat Jordan. Now, Pat, I found the vault for your article in Sports Illustrated from 1972. Some really great stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me, and you don't have to read very far, is the subheader. You know, the pitching wonders, he works, he did not come swiftly. Tom Seaver was not a natural athlete. Even in the article, it's mentioned how from a body, from a physique, he didn't look like Adonis. And you painted different pictures of Seaver. And it's funny, Pat, this is an article that's out there. Anybody could find it. But that part of Seaver not talked about very often.
I don't know why. He was never Tom Terrific. He made himself into Tom Terrific by sheer act of will. I mean, he was a modestly talented guy until he became 20 years old, when all of a sudden he gained 20 pounds and he went to the Alaska Gold Panthers League during the summer, and his fastball went from 88 to 95. But the secret to Tom is when his fastball was 88 in high school and he was getting ripped, he was learning where to throw the ball. He had great control. Now when he comes back 20 pounds heavier in a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, he's hitting the black wherever he wants. So he's almost like one of those control pitchers with no good fastball, you know, they've always got to nibble around the plate. He's doing it with a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, because Tom never had a breaking ball that was worth anything. And he was a fastball pitcher. Who was the catcher for the Cardinals?
McCarver.
Told me. He said, Tom all times did throw fastballs. He said, you get two strikes, you knew it was going to be a fastball. But the question was where? Low and away, up and in, what? And he said, you didn't have a breaking ball. And he said the fastest pitch he ever caught was in an All-Star game from Tom Seaver. Hmm. He said the ball hit my glove. He said it was the most, had more speed on it than anybody I ever caught.
You know, I'm listening to you talk about Seaver. It's amazing because you had a minor league career. You were talented, as you said. You walked a lot of batters in that short time in the minor leagues. The difference between Seaver, who had, as you described, up until a certain point, mediocre talent and then became talented, and many others is this, and you saw it after he stopped playing with how he approached his wine business, is this innate desire to win at all costs and the attention to detail. It's a gift, Pat. I don't think everybody, you could try to have it. You could try to push yourself. Not everybody has that gift to push themselves to the zenith.
It's not to win as much as it is to perfect.
And that's
Tom had
very
to
well
perfect
said.
His talent. And if he could lose 1-0. You know what I mean? Like if he hung a pitch and got hit a home run, he wouldn't like it. But he would say after the game, I pitched as good as I could. You know, I pitched perfectly. You know, he could say, I struck out 16. I didn't walk anybody, and I gave one high fastball. The guy hit a home run. He said, I can't be much more perfect than that. So it's not just winning. It was perfecting. He was a perfectionist. And if he told me when I'm 40 years old and I'm doing what I know I could do at 40 – and they're hitting me, I could live with that, you know, because I'm doing the best I can. You know, if I got an 88-mile-an-hour fastball and I can no longer blow it by anybody and I'm winning 6-5, he said, I could live with that if that's the best I can do. He said, I can't live with it if I can do better than that.
You know, there's you mentioned earlier about if Tom doesn't get traded to Cincinnati. He doesn't win 300 games, probably. But there's a couple of what ifs that we talked about during the lockout dead time. You have those kind of programs where you're trying to just figure things out. So two what ifs with Tom, and I'm curious your thoughts. One, if Gil Hodges doesn't pass away, does his Mets career trajectory change? Does he stay a Met? Number two is a little bit more of a nuanced one and different. Tom was hurt in 1986. He couldn't pitch in the World Series. Al Nipper had to take the ball in game, four?
Was that Red Sox?
That's the Red Sox. If Tom is pitching game four, Red Sox up 2-1 against his former team, I understand that's a different version of Tom. Does that change that World Series? Does that – the Mets don't blow out the Red Sox in game four? Very interesting. Two very interesting what-ifs. Nobody knows, but you know Tom on a personal level. Maybe you wanted to weigh in on that and get your thoughts.
First of all, I never followed Tom's career once he left the Mets that much. I mean, because I followed him doggedly from the late 60s to the late 70s. But after he went to Cincinnati and bounced around, I wasn't a Seaver fan that I knew every statistic. I don't even remember him pitching for the Red Sox. I know he pitched for the Red Sox. But I don't remember all the details of his career in his later life, right? By that time, we were just friends. And I would stop by and talk to him about his pitching or something and write a story. But I didn't follow him. When I was younger, when I was in my early 30s, I followed him religiously. I mean, if he pitched on a Saturday night, I was in front of the television watching him. But not as he got older. So I don't know the Gil Hodges thing and the Red Sox injury. You know, let's see. You said the Red Sox was 86?
Yep. Yep, so it's much later.
Tom, let's see. So I was 45. So Tom would have been 41.
Yep. It was last year of his big league career. Yeah, last year.
41, 41, 42. Yeah, I don't think, you know, at that point, I think you figured it was the luck of the draw.
Sure. You know, what made you write Tom Seaver and Me? You wrote it in 2020. Obviously, Tom passed, and I'm assuming you never read the book. What made you write this book, and how was it for you being that
this, obviously this relationship was very personal to you, going back many, many years.
Yeah, I just wanted to, because I always heard a lot of people talk about saying he was arrogant, he was rude, he was this, all that. He might have been, but so I was too, so I never noticed it, you know. And we were very similar. I always thought that the only thing I wanted to do with the book was to show people the guy that Tom Seaver was when he let his hair down. And he always let his hair down with me. He said things with me, some of which I never used, you know. And he never told me not to use it. You know, for example, the crane pull story that I just told you, I never used that.
Interesting.
Because I knew he didn't say don't. I don't. After he said about how crane pull not hitting the ball into the bleachers because he was too fat and didn't get enough muscle, doesn't have enough muscle. He never said, don't print that, Pat, or don't use that. I never used it because, you know, he was playing with the Mets, and I wasn't going to get him in trouble. Even during the book, I didn't mention it. I don't think I used the name Crane Pool. Maybe I did. But by that time, Tom was gone, so it didn't make much difference anymore. So Tom never pulled back is what I'm saying. And he never did anything that if I revealed it, for example, like guys who you see him on the road in a restaurant with a woman who's not their wife, for example, and writers don't write it. That would never happen with Tom. He wasn't that kind of guy, you know. And so there wasn't much that I had to worry about, like to protect him, because he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, he and I were just two arrogant guys going at it. And we loved it.
You know, he never publicly, he was always very gracious. Now, the Mets opened up Citi Field in 2009. We know we mentioned earlier the complicated history between the two sides. They honored him at the All-Star game in 2013. And I think, and I remember that night, I think Tom was already, although nobody knew it, Tom was already not feeling well. I remember looking at him and saying, Tom doesn't see himself. During that interview, during the 2013 All-Star game. But was Tom ever, what you could share, upset about the former ownership group and how they really just ignored Mets history, really ignored him, made Citi Field very vanilla? And obviously, again, I go back, there's nothing wrong with honoring Jackie Robinson. But, you know.
I know, but he was with the Dodgers.
But it's not a Met. He's not a Met. Let's put it that way. It's like, you know, it's like you have somebody else's portraits. You have a house. Your family is nowhere to be found, but you have your next door neighbor's portraits up.
I didn't talk to him about that much, but everybody who knew him during those years told me he wanted to be the pitching coach. He wanted to be the manager. He wanted to be a general manager.
But could he have been a pitching coach? But Pat, really, let's be honest. He couldn't be. I don't see that as – I know he wanted to be, but Tom, just listening to him, and I don't know the guy, listening to him on the broadcast, he would not have had the patience for a young pitcher.
No, not only that. How many drop and drive pitchers were there in the mid-80s? Roger Clemens is the only one who resembles Seaver in the way he threw. Drop and drive and relying on his legs and his strength, you know. I was a tall and fall guy. If Tom Seaver was ever my pitching coach, he would have ruined me. You know? That's why Tom had no overhand curveball, because he dropped down so low to the ground, he could never get his arm enough to get the ball to have the proper trajectory to go down. I was a tall and fall guy, so I was falling from practically standing straight up, which made my overhand curveball go straight down.
Right.
So, no, it's like Warren Spahn.
Right.
He never was a pitching coach. Ted Williams wasn't a hitting coach.
He was a manager.
But he was a manager, but he was never a hitting coach. The greatest hitter of all time. He came to speak in spring training one year with the minor league Braves in Waycross, Georgia. Ted Williams came to speak to the hitters around home plate, one of the diamonds. And I went over there as a pitcher to see what he had to say, figure I could learn something. And he was telling the guys, he said, now, when you see the spin on the ball is going to be a slider, you have to pull away from it because he's trying to jam you with the slider inside and blah, blah, blah. He said, now, if you see the spin on the ball is spinning up, You know it's a fastball, so it's going to rise, and blah, blah, blah. So he says, and then he says, when you see the spin on the curveball is going down, you know it's going to break at your feet, right? And all the players are nodding. Ted Williams leaves, and they all look at each other and say, who the hell sees the spin on a curveball and a slider and a fastball? Only Ted Williams, whose eyes were, what, 10-20 or 20-10 or whatever it is?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they couldn't. So he's going to tell them how to pick up the spin of the curveball when they can't see it.
They can't, yeah. That's different. So, yeah.
Like that, yeah. Telling Hank Aaron said, well, just wait on the fastball until it's in, and then use your wrist to pull it over third base. Well, who's got Hank Aaron's wrist?
Yeah. These are elite athletes. And look, I'd be remiss. I mean, you have this relationship with Tom, and you got to meet Tom. I want to talk about your, because I think your career, as short as it was, is a lesson. But one last thing about Tom, I think he had the Lyme's disease, terrible situation there, and then he had dementia, and that's a terrible way, because you're waiting for the end, and you don't know when it's going to happen. It sounds like in some of the reading that I've done, you lost a little contact there towards the end because Tom wasn't feeling well. With your last interactions with Tom, is there anything you could share that you remember?
Well,
you know,
I went into the room when he was about 73, I guess. And he was the time saver I knew. He had short-term memory loss, like when we were having breakfast and I ate pancakes in front of him. And then the girl took my plate away and he said, hey, you didn't have any breakfast. But I just had pancakes right in front of him. So I didn't make much of that. But when it came to recall batters he had faced or games he had pitched, he had total recall. It's like when you get old, you remember when you were a baby, you can't remember what you had for breakfast.
That is funny. Interesting how the mind works.
I've got notes all over the damn house with what I have to do every day, so I don't forget, you know?
You didn't forget showing up for this show. That's a start.
I got it right on my coffee pot in big red letters.
There you go.
I got my dog's pills. Got to be 6 o'clock in the morning, phenobarbital, and 6 at night. I got it on the coffee pot.
That's great. Will you be watching any highlights, replays of the unveiling? Do you want to stay away from it? Like you're not interested.
No, I'm not interested. I was interested in Tom Seaver when he was alive. That's all. I mean, I'm glad anything happens to him in death is fine, but it's a little late.
One of the things that I like going to Pat Jordan's stories, and I'm not an anti-stat guy, anti-analytics guy,
yeah.
But what I grew up in the 80s enjoying about baseball, and I've always enjoyed with books, is storytelling. I think that's what's interesting. I failed all my biology, math, regents. I'm not that guy. You know, I it never was me. You have a book called The Fall Spring, which if you go back, your career, and I think it's important for the listeners to know that you were a minor league pitcher. You can go to Baseball Reference. Pat Jordan's there. Pitched from 18 to 20 in the Milwaukee Braves organization. You struck out a lot of guys, Pat, but you walked a heck of a lot of guys. You would have drove. Look, pitchers that walk batters drive me crazy. I love you, Pat. You've been a great interview here, but watching you pitch those walks would have drove me crazy sitting in the stands. I'm like,
What do you mean drove you crazy? Drove me crazy. I won't pitch a game. I struck out 12 out of the first 15 batters, right? 5 innings. I struck out 12 out of 15. Started the 6th inning, walked the first 6 guys. That's it. They bring in a relief pitcher. He gives up a double. I give up 6 runs, no hits, nothing. I gave up 6 earned runs without a hit and a loss. And my earned run average balloons.
And by because today, and I'll tell you what, Pat, today they would not get rid of you at age 20. You know why? Because you had a live arm. You could have pitched another 5-10 years because they always, today, there'd be a team that would want to see what there's left. But they don't see.
That was the best thing the Braves ever did for me, man, because if I kept, I would have been a 28-year-old AAA guy. And it would have been too late for me to go into another profession.
So that and, they did you a favor at 21, getting basically saying goodbye.
Just like the Mets did Tom a favor when they sent him to Cincinnati, which was a better hitting team. He could win 300. The Braves did me a favor. I had to find out what else I wanted to do in my life because my career was over at 20. You know,
I got to tell you, Pat, the one thing I think people who listen to this will take away is that statement about Tom going to Cincinnati. You know how that's a very innocuous statement. It's a true statement. I can't argue with that. And I'll also say, and I've said this and people got mad at me, from a standpoint of how we evaluate trades today, the Mets got back talented players. Obviously, they weren't Tom Seaver, but they really weren't in a position of strength. The two controversial things about the trade is Seaver was better off because he went to a championship team and left the rebuilding team. And the Mets got, in theory, talented, young, controllable players. Either that or they would go out. You know, there's rumors that it was Don Sutton. They could have traded him to L.A. and all that stuff. But by today's standards, when you trade a star, you want to get quantity of talented players. And they got that.
Yeah.
You know,
actually, they didn't. None of those guys did not much of anything. And I mean, Jesus, how could you trade Tom Seaver? I mean, when he how could you trade a guy in the middle of the season and the team you trade him to, he goes 14-1? I mean, aren't you embarrassed? Wouldn't you hide your head?
I don't think M. Donald Grant was embarrassed because you didn't have baseball people there. I mean, I'll tell you what, today, and I see writers writing about it, Howie Rose, the Mets' longtime announcer, said this is a very emotional day. Tom Seaver, what's amazing to me about Tom, and I don't know if he knew this, there's a generation of Mets fans that some who quit watching the Mets because of Tom being traded, some who to this day can't get over it. And it's interesting how one player on a team of 25, and baseball's not the NBA, one player can make things better, but you can't win because of Tom Seaver. Obviously, the Mets proved that. He's a big piece of winning. He can't do it by himself. It's amazing the impact. Did he know the impact he had on people who never met him because of what he did on the mound? Oh, yeah. Did he realize that? Because I don't know how – that's a surreal feeling, I would think.
People were always in awe, but he was funny. He didn't like to talk to strangers. You know, I mean, he's not one of those guys who's crazy about signing autographs to people. I think it was Carlton Fisk when he was at the White Sox. This is a funny story. And they look alike. I mean, if you don't know the two guys, Fisk and Seaver, and you just see a couple of pictures, they do a look alike, you know, the boyish look, big, sturdy guys and all. So in Chicago, some people would mistake Seaver for Fisk because Fisk was more famous in Chicago at the time than Seaver was. Fisk and Seaver were having dinner, and when some fan come over and put a scorecard in front of Tom. He said, "Mr. Fisk, I'm one of the great friends of yours. Would you please sign my autograph?" So Tom goes ballistic, starts cursing the fan and everything. And the fan slinks off, right?
Yeah.
And so Fisk says, "Thanks, Tom." He said, "That's just what I need. I'm just trying to change my image from being a grouchy old guy in Chicago, and you just destroyed it with one person."
And Fisk is still. I know people have met him at Hall of Fame ceremonies. Fisk could still be pretty grouchy to this day. So it's interesting.
Well, he's one of the great interviews I ever did. Carlton Fisk. I love
really.
That. I did him a story. Yeah. Oh, he was 44 and he wanted to catch another year, and the White Sox didn't want him to.
Right.
They said he was a bad influence on the catchers. The guy's a Hall of Fame catcher. How could he be a bad influence on young catchers?
You know what? There's many of bizarre situations out there that come out of baseball. Hey, is there anything that you want those who are listening, those who are Mets fans? Is there something about Tom, and we've talked about it a lot throughout this conversation, that maybe they don't know? Something, not that you know anything salacious or anything too personal. Like, is there something you want them to walk away? They know Tom, the 300-game winner. They know Tom, the Met. They know Tom from the broadcast booth. Ironically, even the Yankee broadcast booth. That's how ironic it is. But do you do you have anything that you know you'd like them to know about Tom that they should know because they have this connection?
Well, they should know he's a perfect athlete. All he wanted to do is perfect.
Sure.
I mean, he was the most disciplined guy I ever met. And I learned a lot from him because I was an undisciplined guy, you know, at the age of 30. But he was a role model for me in how to, if you got something, a talent, whatever it is, keep your mouth shut, work hard at it. Don't bitch and moan. Try to perfect it the best way you can. Take the bad rap that you get with it. And I learned a lot about growing up with Tom. And even though I was 4 years older than him.
Interesting.
He taught me a lot.
Is that why, and I have to bring this up for the listeners, if you go to Pat's baseball reference page, yes, he was out of baseball at the age of 20 in 1961. But in 1997, when Bobby Valentine's the manager of the Mets, this is no more Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris when Pat last pitched, you went back and you pitched an inning in the Independent League in Waterbury, Connecticut. Walked the batter. It would not be a Pat Jordan inning without a walk, but you got through a scoreless inning at the age of 56. You got to tell me about that. That's amazing.
You missed the most important part. I struck out the cleanup hitter with three pitches with a man on second.
This team had Dave Fleming, a former big leaguer, and Doug Pyatt, a former big leaguer on it. So there's a couple of big leaguers. It is independent ball, but a couple of big leaguers in there. So you did strike out. You got to tell me about that experience. You're 56. You're playing with a bunch of 4A, 25, 30-year-olds.
That's a funny story.
But they're good. But they're good. I think people have to understand it. Before I let you talk, don't discount the talent level. These are good former big, these guys are minor leaguers here. So, they're better than guys like me.
They were double A. Yeah. But there's the thing. We go there. My wife, we come from Florida. My wife's a blonde, tanned and all that. We go. I'm there, the old guy. And they're doing calisthenics, and I'm just sitting in the grass while the young kids, I didn't even know any of them. And so they're doing calisthenics, and they're going, hell, look at that blonde over there. Man, I'm going to, they're doing the whole baseball thing. I said, you guys couldn't handle that. I said, I'll go over there. I'll get a hotel key right away. Get out of here, old man, Okay. So I go over to her. I say, Susan, give me the hotel key. She said, why? Where are you going? I said, just give me the key. So I get the key. And I come back and I show it to the guys. I said, see? And they say, oh, the old guy still got it. The whole thing. I never told him it was my wife.
That's great.
If you can't get laid by your wife, then you can't get laid.
I can't disagree. That might be the best quote of the whole conversation. Hey, so Pat, listen, I want everybody, before I let you go, patjordanstories.com. You could go there. You could get the best of his sports writing. The book, obviously, Simon & Schuster, Tom Seaver and Me. Check it out. You got some stuff coming up. Let the listeners know. I'm assuming they could go to your website as your new work comes out. What do you got coming up? And, baseball stuff. You got some, interesting non-baseball stuff.
Yeah, I have a memoir about my father, who was a con man, grifter, and a gambler all his life. And I grew up as a con man's son, so the title is My Father's Con. And one of the lessons I learned, the very first lesson as a five-year-old, was when you're a con man's son, the first thing you got to learn is how to lie. Because everything you said was always a lie. And he was a great guy. Taught me a lot of stuff. And he had a bad life. He grew up in an orphanage. His mother was an Italian immigrant. She had him when she was 16 and immediately gave him up for adoption. And he spent the first 15 years of his life in a state orphanage.
Interesting.
And at 15, they threw him out in the street and he had to make his way in the world. So he had a really rough life. I think it's the best thing I've ever done. And I cried my way through it, because everybody in my family that I wrote about is dead. I'm the last one living.
Wow.
And it's a really good book. There's some baseball in it, and there's other sports, but it's funny, and it's a little sad. It's a lot sad, some of it. And anyway, what else? I'm writing another book, but I can't even mention it. I'm writing a lesbian noir crime thriller, believe it or not.
That's just
a, about a group of lesbians who have a crime, have a small crime syndicate. And
there's a dearth of good stories out there, and nothing is too off the table these days. So that'll be interesting.
Not anymore. Yeah.
No, not anymore. Things,
look, somebody told me, interviewed me about Joan Joyce, who just died, the softball pitcher. And she would have loved Seaver, and Seaver would have loved her. And then Mary Jo Pepler, who won the superstar competition. She was a volleyball player. And, you know, we were talking about lesbians in sports and all that. I said, geez, in those days, you couldn't even admit it.
Wow.
I said, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, I said, you couldn't even talk about it.
You got a female first base coach for the Giants the other day. The world has changed quite a bit. Baseball's changed. And I think the thing, you know, baseball gets criticized a lot. But I think, you know, from this the conversation that comes from it, I love the NBA. You know, I watch football and not so much hockey, but I love the NBA. But nothing brings out good radio. And I grew up listening to games on radio more than TV.
The problem with baseball, Mike, is that the people who gravitate to it are conservative. The problem with baseball is not because they're keeping certain people out in different places, but the problem is it's a conservative game, and most of the people who play it have the same kind of conservative attitude. For example, there are not as many American blacks in baseball today, right?
Right.
Why? Because football and basketball are much more lucrative and much quicker for them to be successful.
And, well, I'll throw you something else for any athlete of any age or gender or background, and you are a perfect example of it. Baseball, you could have the best athletic talent. You threw hard. It takes so long to hone because of the nuance of it. It's not for everybody. And from a financial standpoint, and I know they're trying to change that, but you're never going to be 18 years old for the most part and make – 10, 12, $15 million like you can in the NBA.
I mean, you're going to be in the minor leagues until you're 25, say, and making nothing and having to have a part-time job selling cars. Yeah.
And you might have to wait till 30. You have to make till you're 30 years old. You know, and I know people say, well, you get called up, you make $700,000. All due respect, 1 year of $700,000 is nice, but it's not going to last you a lifetime. Not today, not even back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It's great. Pat, you've been very generous with your time. I wish we could do more. Let's do it again. Keep in touch. And thank you again.
Mike.
We know Tom Seaver's Hall of Fame numbers on the field, but former teammate Skip Lockwood joined the Talking Mets podcast to share how Tom helped him during his career.
I can't tell you how much importance Tom Seaver had on my career, helping me to refine my skills and understand the science of pitching. Not that pitching is scientific, but to understand why you're getting players out and what you're doing that's impacting the movement of the baseball and pitching of the count situation and who should be started off with a curveball and who shouldn't and why. He was such an architect in a baseball uniform. He made a big difference in my career.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. I thought Pat Jordan had some really interesting things to say. I mean, I think one of the most revealing things, and I don't think it's a surprise, but I think it's probably one of the more hurtful things that came out of the interview was Seaver telling Pat, I probably don't win 300 games if I stay with the Mets. I mean, we did a what-if history with the Mets back, if you remember, what our good friend John Strubel of Mets Rewind back in January or February, right in the middle of the lockout. And one of the what-ifs was, what happens? A couple of things. What if Gil doesn't die? Does Seaver stay? Does Ryan maybe not get traded? All those different things. What happens if they keep Seaver? And does Gooden get a chance to come on the 84 team?
Seaver could have easily been on the 85 or a back end of the rotation guy on the 86 team. Obviously, that impacts Aguilera and Fernandez and maybe even the Mets going after and getting Bobby Ojeda. You don't know. And obviously, the Mets tried to bring Seaver back in 87 when they had all those pitching injuries, but he had nothing left. And then one of the more ultimate what-ifs is instead of Al Nipper, like I brought up to Pat Jordan, what if Seaver starts game four of the World Series against his former team in New England, in Boston? You just don't know. It's just amazing. But that, the Crane Pool story, Eddie Crane Pool, a highly touted prospect who had a long career but turned out to be more of a component player, pinch hitter type of player. So very interesting stuff coming out of Pat Jordan. Pretty honest. Talked about his own career. And I'll tweet it out. I have the link. Tom Terrific and his mystic talent from July 1972, Sports Illustrated. Always interesting to go back and look at some of those old Sports Illustrated articles and then look at what was said, how things were talked about back then and what have you. So I hope you enjoyed. I mean, really what I've been meaning to do since I knew the Seaver statue was going to be unveiled was make this weekend about Tom Seaver. And I didn't know how to do it. There's so many ways to do it. And Pat Jordan, I thought, was the perfect guy, somebody we hadn't had on the show yet, somebody that wrote a book about Seaver and knew Seaver personally and could give us a few anecdotes and things that perhaps we have not heard before. So hopefully you enjoyed that. As far as the team, first test coming up, the Giants also 7-2 coming in. So we get a chance to see last year's NL West champs. And the last time the Giants were at Citi Field, these were two teams going in opposite directions. Mets, I think, scored about 3 runs a game in August when they played all those games between the Giants and the Dodgers, and their season really unraveled. And the Giants were a team, as you saw when they came to Citi Field last August, that were making that jump after the trade deadline to being who they were, which was a championship-caliber club. So it's an early season test. Like I said, I don't get crazy about anything one way or the other. I'm not going to get crazy about great performances. I'm not going to get crazy about bad performances. There's a lot of good vibes around this team. And let's just keep it at that. We're continuing to get to know the 2022 Mets, the good, the bad, the ugly. There's a lot of good. And I don't think the starting rotation is going to pitch to 1.17 ERA forever. So, you know, buckle up. There's going to be a few games that you might have to, you know, say, hey, he didn't have it, but let's have fun while we're watching it. And certainly this was a great, great weekend to be a Mets fan. Great weekend at Citi Field, great weather, a great ceremony to celebrate Mets history. And so far, our 2022 Mets talking Mets season is really off to a rocking start. Now, one last thing before you go, because you may have noticed, and if you didn't, pay attention. So we usually come back from commercial to the Jane Jarvis organ. And I've taken that from many, you know, from YouTube and then from, I think I got the last one from Once Upon a Time in Queens from the Spotify audio. Now, probably I shouldn't use any of this stuff. I could probably get sued for trademark infringement. I don't care. I mean, sue the Talking Mets podcast. I mean, what do you think? You think that you got a million-dollar brand over here? I wish I did. I'd come to you every day if I could make it a living, but, you know, I got some bills to pay. So we got to do it in a way that fits into me, you know, keeping a roof and a studio over my head. But a fan of the show, at @Clay_Senator, Senator Clay Davis, he's not the real Senator Clay, not a real senator. So if you think a senator in the United States, if you think someone from the U.S. Senate's listening, he's not. One day I'll tell you about someone who used to work for President Trump that actually listened to the show, but I'll leave that for another day. Former President Trump that listened to the show. And I don't think he follows me anymore. I'll give that to you another day. I'll tease that another day. But anyway, it's his moniker. It's the senator from The Wire. Great show. If you haven't watched it, watch it. So I don't know if that's, I'm sure that's not his real name, but he sent me somebody he knows. I'm not going to say, you know, who it is. The relationship anyway. Rob Kluge, who apparently is very talented, did the whole piano rendition of Jane Jarvis coming back from commercial. So I used it, and I want to give him credit, and I'm tweaking it a little bit to try to make it it good. If you notice, I'm trying to clean up some of the little fringiness about the show. You know, this is a homebrewed show. I'm not an audio professional. I got some pretty good equipment now. I mean, we've really improved from the early days. I was actually listening to some early shows from 2007, 2008, even 2011. I'm like, oh man, that was brutal. But back then, that was the technology. It worked. So what are you going to do? So hopefully, got to give credit where credit's due. Rob Kluge. The only reason I got his name right is because he phonetically pronounced it for me, the senator. So, you know, that's the way it is. And posthumous, right? Is that the way I'm supposed to say it? I saw some joking around on Twitter how I almost botched posthumous the last show. And then I stopped and I said, I'm not going to say it because it's going to come out disrespectfully. So, yeah, Seaver posthumous. That's the other one over there. So, anyway, I hope everybody had a good Easter Sunday. I hope you had a good Passover. I hope you're enjoying the season so far. First test series. Let's see where the Mets are at with the Giants this week. 4-game set at Citi Field and then on to the road to play the D-backs. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week, so buckle up. A lot to talk about. Hopefully you enjoyed this one. Of course, you can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I want to thank the good folks over at the Fansided Podcasting Network and RisingApple.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Have a great Easter. Have a great Passover. Have a great Ramadan. Whatever you celebrate, have a great one. Till next time, take care, everybody.
For the park and greet the Mets. Hot dogs, green grass, all out of shade. Guaranteed to have a heck of a day, because those Mets are really rocking that ball, hitting those home runs over the wall.
Hola, in Jersey, Brooklyn, Queens, a town is down.
Let's go Mets, that's the cheer all over New York town.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.